was reading one of these seed catalogs, you know, for garden cuckoos, and he said there was he said there was an ad for a little hoe, you know, these little things with a handle on it that you chop away at the dandelions. And it said, the description included the line, "It breaks up clods." And he said he feels that that's a very fine description to apply to several notorious comics who keep showing up on the late night talk shows. Breaks up clods. Oh, you got to think about that. Oh, by the way, before we get started here tonight, we got some very important things to note. As you know, as part of our artistic debt, which we owe to life in general, we like to keep people aware of, the passing parade. And we figured that, 1,000 years from now, somebody may be playing these tapes and they want to know what it was really like in this time, as opposed to what we write and say what it was like. There's a big difference there. And that we would like to make a salute there, please. Would you please give me my my salute tape, please? A new development here, which I think you should know about. A note on the Associated Press from Baltimore. A burly ex-Marine, Edward R. Sim, kept a stiff upper lip and basked in his role as the first man elected May Queen at the Baltimore Community College. "It started out as a joke," he explained, wearing a tiara over his flowing blonde hair and a toga-like, quote, gown designed by his girlfriend. Sim added that his biggest complaint about the $4,000 affair is that, quote, is it's an inappropriate use of student activity funds. However, I enjoy being Queen of the May. So we'd like to salute Mr. Sim out there. Thank you. Huh? Hold it there. By the way, speaking of saluting, we would like to salute a very famous historical person out of the past, because this is an important day, and the reason he's famous, probably nobody would ever even know the name today, but this is the anniversary of what happened to him that made him famous. Do you know the name Henry H. Bliss? You ever heard of Mr. Bliss? Anyone ever heard of Mr. Bliss in there? We're consulting our think tank in the control room there. We have these heavy thinkers in there. Now, if I'd ask them something about Marvel comic books, they might know. But we'll ask you a question here. Any of you ever heard of Henry Bliss? Well, Mr. Bliss was a famous man 72 years ago today, in 1899. Real estate broker Henry H. Bliss, 68, stepped from a New York City streetcar into history. Mr. Bliss, in 1899... 72 years ago today, was struck by an automobile as he alighted. Remember, that's 1899. And it was all over for him. He was DOA. He was the first person in the country whose death was caused by an automobile. So let us give a salute to the memory of Mr. Bliss, please. Oh, hooray, hooray, for the memory of old Henry who started the whole damn thing. Hooray for poor old Henry H. Bliss, yeah, the first innocent bystander. Hooray for the name of Henry Bliss, who stepped into heaven and history on that great day 72 years ago today. Hooray for Henry Bliss. Bum, bum. However, I must admit, we do not have the name of the type of car that hit him, which would also be an interesting bit of historical trivia. But we do have the name of Henry Bliss. And so let's all sing it out loud and clear. Loud. Sing it out cleanly, because Mr. Bliss was the first of a long line. The first. Hooray for Henry Bliss. Hooray for Henry H. Bliss. Yes, Bliss, Bliss. Hooray, hooray. We say hooray. Henry Bliss started the whole damn thing. Poor old Henry Bliss. He was just riding down to see his dentist. He stepped off the streetcar at Ka-pa-pa-pow! And Henry Bliss became a name in history. So, hold it there. That's just thought you ought to know that this is a historical day. You just keep listening to this show, and I'll tell you, just be filled with all kinds of important, interesting stuff. Henry Bliss. You know, the automobile, of course. Yeah, this is a good time to bring this subject up. The automobile has played a great role in all of our lives. And even though you may not even have a car, you know, you may not have anything to do with cars, but the automobile has transformed your life, at least the life of anybody in the 20th century. And Mr. Bliss, of course, began the whole thing. And tonight, we would like, I don't know how to approach this, but are there any hobby people out there? I mean, everybody's got some kind of a hobby. Hey, does anyone have a dictionary? How do you define hobby? You have a dictionary? Would you run back to the newsroom, Jerry, please, and take a look at that very official dictionary they have back there? It's, you know, weighs about 40 pounds. It's on a stand, you know, the kind that they wheel around. And just look up hobby, because I think everybody's got some kind of a hobby, even if he doesn't say much about it. Now, the hobby may not be an official hobby, you know, like collecting stamps, that kind of stuff. I've never had that kind of a hobby. I've always wondered how people get into one of these really conventional hobbies, you know, like collecting coins. Now, collecting coins is not the same as collecting dough. You agree to that? I mean, a coin, you know, is a coin, but money is money. And I've known many people whose hobby was collecting as much cash as they could lay their hands on. I mean, you know, I suppose the most classical one in history is a famous, or rather, at least in literature, is a famous literary character, you know, known as a miser. Do they still have misers these days? They do. Oh, now, wait a minute. Don't bring the management into this. They have nothing to do with it. I mean, I haven't heard of a good, really serious miser for a long time. I mean, you know, the word is a great word, too. And speaking of misers, hey, listen, I heard a great line the other night talking about misers. I was sitting in this restaurant, see, and once in a while, you just hear one great line just comes whistling out all through the, you know, through the garbage of human conversation, you know, the general rubble, the uproar. Suddenly, one line comes out, and you just can't forget it. And there's this beautiful chick, see, she's about four tables over, and she's with these two people. And she's talking to these two people. Now, at this point, I had paid very little attention to what she was saying. I was more, you know, looking at her. I wasn't listening to her so much. And, well, you know, that's all. I'm human. I'm just like everybody else, see. So I'm sitting there, and the fettuccine had arrived, and, you know, the whole thing. And the Luigi, the waiter, had come and given me that $8 bottle of 75-cent wine, you know. And so I'm sitting there talking away with the friends I was with, when all of a sudden I hear this line, great line. She says, you know, I can't understand George. And I turn. I know at least 15 guys named George. See, she says, I can't understand George. And this has been said about almost every George I know, one way or another, see. So I thought, you know, maybe she knows George. So she says, I can't understand George. She says, I just can't understand. She says, he probably thinks he looks very hip with that long hair he's got. She says, he's got this long hair. The only trouble is, it's very thin on top. And she says, it makes him look like Silas Marner. Oh, God. What a terrible thing. You know, I could see George, you know, with his Edwardian double-knit suit. No, he thinks he's really with it, you know. He thinks that any, you know, if three out of five people are going to mistake him for the cutest beetle of them all, you know, and he's walking down the street with his great suit, with his double-knit shirts and the whole bit, and this girl who sees him thinks he looks more like Silas Marner than anybody else. Well, now, do you know who Silas Marner was? Well, I have to ask, of course you do, naturally. All of us have known a Silas Marner in our life of one kind or another. Did you get the definition of hobby, please, Jerry? All right, what is it? It's his hobby. A specialized pursuit that is outside of one's regular occupation and that one finds particularly interesting. All right, George, very good. Make it happen. I mean, you know, you never know about this stuff. No, I mean, life is really mysterious. I mean, let's face it, about 75% of our life is composed of total mystery. And you just accept it. You don't question it. And after a while, because you begin to realize that it's just mystery, that's all. It's like George, the guy that I was hearing about in the restaurant. Sitting out there trying to pretend he's Silas Marner, growing his hair down the back, you know, cackling. I suppose there's something in George's soul, though, that shines through his eyes, which is pure Silas Marner. You know, cackling and throwing money up in the air. But, you know, speaking of hobbies and cars, we would like to take tonight a little time out here to salute a truly dedicated man. Now, there aren't many men that are dedicated in our time. I mean, he's so dedicated that he's surrounded by enemies. Most dedicated men are. And don't worry about that thing. That's not our problem. Let them worry about it later. We're not going to do it tonight. So, no, don't worry about it. That's actually on the tape. That's right. That's why I said that mouth-to-mouth worked in that case. It's okay. But I would like to salute tonight, if I may, Robert C. Reynolds. And I have a note from one of our spies. And I'm glad that I have this note because Mr. Reynolds is one of the few dedicated men that I've encountered in a long time. And he's dedicated to something, I think, a little more than average. You see, when a man is just dedicated to collecting as many dollar bills as, you know, he can in one lifetime, that's not really something that you want to write a short story about or applaud particularly, because it's a normal human thing. But we would like to salute Robert C. Reynolds. And here's a story about him. I'm holding this. It's going to be my vast file of trivia. It's going to be, 5,000 years from now, they're going to know that at our time, at least there was two or three people who were dedicated to something larger than themselves. And Robert C. Reynolds, and we're quoting here the Washington Post, he lives outside of Washington someplace, thinks the Studebaker, which hasn't been made since 1966, was the best car ever manufactured. So Robert C. Reynolds has collected 28 slightly rusted vintage model Studebakers in the backyard of his $100,000 home in McLean, wherever that is. It sounds like a town in Virginia. 4 years ago, Reynolds discovered that his rare collection was illegal when Fairfax County, that's in Virginia, zoning officials sought his arrest for allegedly operating a junkyard in a community zoned only for residential purposes. Since then, the dedicated housing contractor has been engaged in a total battle with zoning officials, his wife Consuela, and the complaining neighbors. He would have a wife named Consuela. Sounds like a name invented by Bob and Ray. Anyway, he's been having a constant battle with his neighbors, his wife Consuela, the housing authorities, and a lot of other people who are very mad just because he has a lot of Studebaker in his backyard. Reynolds has been to court a dozen times on charges of illegally operating a junkyard. He has paid a $200 fine and has spent 5 days in jail. In 1960, this guy's dedicated. In 1969, he refused to obey a court order obtained by his wife to move the cars off their two-acre lot in Selwyn Drive. Gee. But Reynolds, who is currently under an order by zoning officials to move the cars, maintains that county officials have no jurisdiction over his private property. And he says he will continue to fight to keep his collection. And I quote here, this is a fighter, Robert C. Reynolds. You want to hear what he says? He says, why can't people understand that this is a hobby? It's just a hobby, like any other hobby. Well, of course, I can understand that, Mr. Reynolds. Collecting 28 Studebakers in your backyard is a hobby just like any other hobby. Reynolds wondered aloud the other day, and we quote again. We're quoting Robert Reynolds. Some people collect butterflies or beer bottle caps. I collect Studebakers. There isn't much difference, except maybe my collection is a little bulkier. So let us salute Mr. Reynolds. Yes. Oh, Robert Reynolds, you are fighting for truth and freedom. Oh, Robert Reynolds, your 28 Studebakers are groovy. Yeah, Robert Reynolds, You are not collecting junk, junk, junk. You're collecting Studebakers, and everybody knows they're great. The greatest car ever built, built, built. Oh, Robert. Robert Reynolds. We blow the bugles for you. Bump, bump. Bump, bump, bump. Ba-ba-bump, bump. Hold it there, hold it there. There's more to the story. Oh, the red phone is off the hook, I see. That's the one that connects directly with the Kremlin here, and it's off the hook, I see. May get an important call here any minute now. We have another note here, though. We want to continue the story of Mr. Reynolds because it's an important battle here, and it's liable to get to the Supreme Court. After all, they're defining his collection of 28 Studebakers as junk. Well, now, that could cause a lot of excitement. Now, I suppose if you own one Studebaker, it's not junk. Now, if I were fighting this case before the Supreme Court, I could really start, you know, really moving in. Now, no, I mean, junk is junk. Does junk have anything to do with the quantity you have? In other words, one 1953 Studebaker is just your old car, you know? I mean, you keep in your backyard. You have five 1953 Studebakers, you are beginning to verge on junk. You have 28 Studebakers in the backyard, and you got nothing but petitions for miles around. Now, that's a very important point. It's a very interesting point. Now, Mrs. Reynolds, who owns the 15-room, three-story house with a swimming pool, says she has no intention of going to jail with her husband if he is convicted of violating the county's zoning ordinance. That's right. Stick by him, honey. And that she says, and we quote her, "I can agree with him in principle," she said, "that certain vehicles should be restored. But in the 7 years I have known Bob, and in the 4 years I've been married to him, he has never restored one single car. He buys the cars, usually from a junkyard, and drags them up to the house where they just sit and rust," she said. Well, now, now, she says, this is the only street and only house on the street that has wall-to-wall auto parts in the recreation room, she added. And nevertheless, he's been licensing the cars, see, to try to avoid being called junk. He keeps them all currently licensed. That gets kind of high. Reynolds, whose salary is about $15,000 a year, he paid more than $1,000 during that period just to have the cars licensed and insured. All told, Reynolds says he spends about $3,000 a year on the upkeep of his 28 Studebakers out in the backyard. He says he more than likely will get 1972 tags for his cars before the May 20th deadline. That's when this piece was written. He says, but the country, in fact, the whole county is out to get me, he said, as he and in his he has a Studebaker library in his house. This guy's really hung on Studebakers, you know. He's just not hung on any kind of car. It's Studebakers. He has what he calls a Studebaker library, which has Studebaker parts, manuals, and insignias. And he says, Lady Bird started this with her Beautify America business. Now, every time somebody sees an old car, they want to make it into a junkyard. Down with Lady Bird, is what he says. Gee, well, Robert, now you're beginning to verge on the, you know, I think when a guy keeps his cool, he's all right. But as soon as he begins to yell and, you know, stand on soapbox and kick over people's garbage cans because he's mad. Well, anyway, the problem with private citizens collecting old cars is now nationwide. Reynolds says he has received reports from others in the 3,000-member Studebaker Club. There's the Studebaker, Studebaker Cuckoo's Club. He says they've all been, quote, harassed for collecting orphan cars. He says if I collected Buicks, nobody'd get mad. It's the Studebaker that makes them mad. Well, there is some truth in that. There is really some truth in that. In fact, I mean, if you collect 1903 Maxwells, in 1912, Oldsmobiles and curved dash type cars. If you collect a 1906 locomobile, you're considered an elegant connoisseur. That's right. And you can have your whole backyard filled with them, and people come from miles around and pay to get in to see them. But I suspect that we're dealing with some very subtle legal problems here. It's a matter of definition. One man's junk is another man's objet d'art. As a matter of fact, he's a little ahead of his time, Mr. Reynolds, I'd like to point out. He really is. I believe he is because, you know, right here in the village, I live in the village, and you can walk up and down. There's stores in the village that sell nothing but what would be defined by almost anybody who's halfway sane as junk. And it's called the trivia. It's called memorabilia. It's called anything but junk. And if you think it's junk, you ought to try picking up some of that stuff. You've seen it, Jerry, in the winter, you know, little tin toys, you know, the kind that, you know, the stuff that people have been throwing out for years. Like, for example, there's a little tin tricycle in the window of one of them right now that's in the form of a Zeppelin. You know, a little Zeppelin body. You know, it's body. It's got little pedals on the thing, see? Well, that's the kind of stuff you find in any dump. They've been throwing that kind of junk away for ages. You know what that thing goes for now, right there in that the store window there? Are you ready for that? $100 and a quarter. And they laughed at Chauncey when he collected those old tricycles. That's right. Now, I've got to tell you, one day, everybody is laughing about the Edsels. You know, the Edsel is a great joke. Will you try to pick one up cheap one of these days? You're curious? I'm serious. Do you know that if you have a fairly decent conditioned Edsel, and there are certain ones that are far more rare than others. For example, the last year the Edsel was made, they only made about 1,200 cars, and they called it quits. Well, now that's a very rare Edsel. Now, especially if you can get a convertible model of that last year. Did you know they made a convertible? Don't see many of those, do you? Well, an Edsel convertible is worth a lot of dough. And if you can collect three or four of those and park them in your backyard, in spite of what Mrs. Meany down the street says, you are in a position to almost name your own price. Now, on the other hand, if you can pick up a mint condition, 1959 or 60 Edsel station wagon. Hi, George. The Kohinoor diamond has nothing on you. That's true. So, but it took a few years for that to develop. I mean, a couple of years ago, like, say, 5 years ago, you could have picked up Edsels for nothing. You know, it was kind of a joke about buying an Edsel. But not now. And I suspect that this guy with his Studebakers in the backyard, he's sitting on top of a gold mine. And he's got 28 of them. But, you know, speaking of that, is this a hobby or isn't it? When does a hobby verge on a hang-up? That's a good question. In fact, I have a picture down in my office of a guy who lives outside of Lima, Ohio. And, George C., something like George C. Struthers, farmer, and 74. And George C. Struthers is standing in the backyard of his house outside of Lima, Ohio, and he's standing next to his life work. Well, what was his life work? Well, he has a 17-foot high, think about it, 17 feet high, a 17-foot high ball of string that he has collected in his 55-some-odd years of string collecting. And when he was interviewed, George said, and we're talking about Mr. Struthers here, he was interviewed by the reporter who said, if you had it all to do over again, Mr. Struthers, would you do anything different? And he thought about that for a while. And he said, yeah, I would. And he says, what would you do, Mr. Struthers? Well, I'll tell you what I'd do. You know, I didn't start collecting that string till I was damn near 19 years old. If I had started maybe 5-10 years earlier, I'd have one maybe 20 feet high. And his only regret was that he wasted so much of his life. And, so much of his early life when he did not realize his true vocation. Now, that ball of string that stands there in the yard is a mute testimony to man's dedication. And, of course, Mr. Struthers is a man of advanced age. And I imagine that Mr. Struthers has got a will drawn up. Somebody's going to inherit that 17-foot-high ball of string. Which which albeit on the surface sounds like kind of a silly thing to inherit, but if you realize you'd have the only one in the country. And there's not many people can say that they've got the only one of anything in the country. And, you know, it's just kind of nice to go out there and look at it against the sunset and just see it there, because it's there. I mean, after all, what good is Mount Everest? What's it ever done for anybody? And what good is most anything in this life? You know, actually, when you boil it right down, why laugh at that ball of string? I mean, those pyramids are silly. I've seen them. They're just a bunch of bricks that are piled up. And, you know, there it is. When all is said and done, I mean, you're putting value judgment on those Studebakers, lady. I mean, I don't care if your name is Consuela, but nevertheless, the fact, you know, I'm thinking about this now because at one point, I personally got involved in a I hate to say it, that there was a period in my life when I verged on the fanatic. I became a fanatic. And what was I fanatic about? Well, at this point, I still have overtones of it. You know, once you're a fanatic, you never completely grow out of it. There's no way. You know, you may be able to quell it. You may be able to rise above it, but you never get rid of it. But scratch the surface of an ex-fanatic, and you're going to find a fanatic. Just the way life is, right? There's no such thing as an ex-drinker. There's just drinkers that have stopped for a while. That's all. Scratch the, you know, you just can't be. No way. It's like pregnancy. Either are or you ain't, you know. And so, nevertheless, I one day I'm standing around, you know, in the Warren G. Harding School, I believe it was, when Flick comes over to me. And I hadn't seen Flick for about 3 or 4 days. He used to hang around at school all the time, you know, and we'd knock out flies and all that stuff. And Flick comes over, and I see him. I said, "Where you been, Flick?" He says, "I only have a couple of seconds to talk to you." I said, "What's the matter, Flick? What are you doing?" He says, "I'm busy." I said, "Busy doing what?" He's collecting. I said, "Collecting what?" He said, "None of your damn business." Well, see, that's the thing about fanatics. They're often closed-mouthed. Often very closed-mouthed. So, you know, I just let it drop. That's a little strange thing. He didn't often talk. And so a couple of days later, I'm walking around with Schwartz, and I said, "Did you hear about Flick?" He said, "You know, he's flipped his gourd. He's going around, he's working, he's collecting something." And Schwartz says, "Yeah, you know what he's collecting?" I said, "What?" He says, "Wrigley gum wrappers." I said, "What? Wrigley gum wrappers?" He says, "Yeah, you hear about them?" I said, "What do you mean? What about them? Well, you know, I see plenty of Wrigley gum wrappers around." And I says, "What about them?" He says, "Well, you open up the Wrigley gum wrapper, you know, take a stick of gum. You open it up, you just take, you know, where the glue is, you just peel it back, open the thing up, and there's a number in there." I said, "A number? What do you mean, number?" He said, "Yeah, there's a number in there. It's a code. If you get the right number, you win the big prize." I said, "Prize? What prize?" He said, "Well, the Wrigley Gum Company will publish in the wrapper when you get a winning prize. You win all that money." I said, "Money in the gum wrappers?" He said, "That's right." He said, "But you got to collect a lot of gum wrappers." So at that point, I became dedicated. See, motivation is part of fanaticism. And when you're hit at a particularly vulnerable point in your life, at that point, I had just lost my paper route, and I was scratching for dough. So I figured the only other way I could recoup was by collecting gum wrappers. So seriously, I began to collect Wrigley, and the only ones, by the way, that count, in case you're curious, are spearmint Wrigley gum wrappers. And so from that day on, I would walk along the curbs. Just look down at the curb. You see them in the curbs. Just walk along the curb. You know, where the curb comes down, the sewers and all that stuff. You'd be amazed at the number of gum wrappers you find. And so the first day, I must have collected, oh, maybe 500 of them. You know, I had them I carried them in a sack. I got a paper sack, see? And I take them home, and I put them in the basement. Well, after about a month or so, I had about 9 paper sacks running, and I started to empty the paper sacks into gunny sacks. Now, I'm not kidding you. Me and Schwartz and Flick, and it was a guy named Stanley Roper, who I rarely discuss because of one thing that happened one day. Stanley Roper, me and Schwartz and Flick became the premier Wrigley spearmint gum wrapper collectors in the country. And for all that summer, I collected Wrigley spearmint wrappers until, I tell you, I had about 9 gunny sacks filled with them, and I had them stuck under the porch. We had this porch in the backyard. It's the only place I could keep them after a while. You know, spontaneous combustion and all that kind of stuff. probably 20 million gum wrappers. Well, you know how it is. September came, went back to school. And then I began to be interested in other things like Eileen Akers and a few other stuff, like, you know how you do. But I've never forgotten that. I've never completely gotten over my fanaticism. By the way, I did not win any money, as you probably can guess, although Schwartz did. We'll go into that later. It comes next semester. How he won the money has nothing to do with the gum wrappers. So that's something else. It's sickening. Him and Roper, you know? So, it was a rotten trick. But nevertheless, ever since that time, I have never looked at a gum wrapper the way you look at a gum wrapper, which is just a piece of paper. I've even felt the urge from time to time to pick one up when I see it on the street. Just walk along the curb someday and look at gum wrappers. You'd be amazed at the number of wrappers. Poor Robert, you know.
This is Tom.
And now WBJC presents Nightcap, stereo jazz music to end the day.